Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for Biz Rocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Good morning and welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. Happy New Year to all our listeners out there. This is our first show in the new year. And we got a good one today. In the overall outline of our shows, our focus is talking to executives and business owners in the Atlanta area, learning from some of their successes that they've had, the challenges that they've had, and kind of what they can bring to the table for clients that they have, as well as potential employers. And today we've got two individuals that are in the business transition market and business, if you will. Gareth Young is a principal with Abraxas, and Perry Walter is with HH Advisors, LLC. I want to welcome both you guys in today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So I'm going to kind of start off individually, get a little bit of background and maybe kind of your bio, as it were, and then we're going to get into some good questions about what the business environment is like right now for business owners selling, as well as people that are looking at buying, which I think are two very interesting topics for our listeners. So, Gareth, let's start with you. Maybe you could give us a little bit of background on your business and how you got to where you are now.
I'll start many years ago by explaining my accent. I grew up in the UK, left college and went into public accounting, which was general business training. As a young audit manager, they sent me on a management development program to the States. After a couple of years, I married, stayed here, went to Bell South, where I was a deal principal for the best part of 15 years. So I was doing a lot of business transactions in Latin America and the domestic US mostly. I left there about 6 years ago, did a few years as an independent contractor, consultant, a variety of different things, working with a lot of startups as a CFO, COO kind of role. And a couple of years ago, got back into the transaction world with Abraxas. So I help people buy and sell businesses at Abraxas.
And from your past experience when you worked in corporate America, what are some of the things that helped you now understand or be able to add value to somebody who's mm-hmm. looking at either buying or selling a business?
That's a great question. There are two sides to that answer. One is working in the corporate world. I was very, very lucky to work with some incredibly talented and capable people. Learned a lot of sort of textbook marketing and sales techniques and CRM systems and financial records. I mean, how to run a business professionally in a very, very deep way. Those are skills that most small business owners don't have access to. They grew up building their business out of a garage. So that's very important. The second thing, though, was something that happened to me over the 4 or 5 years that I was doing my own thing. The corporate world works very, very differently than the small business world. And so I had to make that transition. And it's one that I just made naturally without spotting it. But it's a very important transition to make. So now I think like a small business guy, not a corporate guy.
Right. You know, that's an interesting thought. It is so different when you're, you know, you saw that there's a commercial where there's a guy that comes into his office and every person looks like him and he's, you know, he is everybody. And there's a little bit of that or a lot of that when you're a small business owner. What do you see as the biggest differences between corporate America or being in corporate America and being in a small business?
in corporate America, people move around a lot. So if you're building relationships and trying to transact business with corporate America, you need to have a team that is building relationships with a team of people that surrounds a position, because the position is going to move. So you've got to know the team around it, and you've got to invest a lot of resources in maintaining that network of relationships. In the small business world, it's very different. You're building relationships with individuals. You're building them with the owner, the CFO. People are going to be there for a long, long time.
Right.
It's a very different nature of relationship building.
Right. Interesting. I hadn't heard it said that way. So if you were to identify groups or sizes or types or specialties that you tend to work with a lot, and I know you work on both the buy and the sell mm-hmm. side, but is there a niche that you tend to work in?
Very simply, it's businesses with revenues of between $5 and $30 million. What we position our business below where investment banks play, and they play very well. They have very, very rich resources, but they also have a high G&A structure, and they typically work with companies who have one of me on the payroll.
Right.
So we position ourselves below that, which is arbitrarily about $30 million of revenue, and above where what we would characterize as Main Street business brokers play. So businesses with some real complexity, where it's a coherent business with transferable value rather than an owner with more of a lifestyle business.
Gotcha. All right, well, great. Gareth, thanks for that background. We'll get back right to you in a second here. Now, Perry, welcome on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate you taking your time today and fighting the rainstorms that came through the Atlanta area.
No problem at all.
I woke up to some serious thunder and lightning.
As did I.
Yeah, good stuff. It wakes you up, though.
That's right.
You kind of want to roll over and go back to bed, quite
you wish
honestly.
It didn't wake you up.
No, I was like, I think I need it. So, Perry, maybe a little bit of background on you and kind of how you got to where you are.
Great. Appreciate it. I've been valuing businesses for about 18 years. My first entree was in the sell-side equity research space. I was at Raymond James, then at Robinson Humphrey, and focused on telecom and technology companies. And I was the guy, the equity research analyst. The guy said, buy, sell, or hold on stocks. But as part of that role, you also get involved with taking companies public, helping them make M&A transactions and what have you. I transitioned from that in 2001, did some entrepreneurial things myself, did some venture capital work. So we were actually the investors doing some investing in smaller companies as opposed to much larger public companies. Also did some various valuation work for various transactions between the 2001-2008 timeframe. And through that, had an opportunity in 2009 to join HH Advisors. The company's been around since 2007. Primarily do business valuation, and through a subsidiary, Vinings Capital, we do M&A transactions sell side primarily. Mm. Very similar to what Gareth had said, we focus on the smaller companies, not the big companies like the Bell Souths of the world or anything like that, but it's the smaller small business owner who's kind of in that 5 to 30 million range, EBITDA or earnings before interest, taxes, and depreciation and amortization of kind of 1.5 to 5 million. And in most cases, a lot of our work on the sell side M&A comes from our valuation work, where we've been helping the owner along the way plan for that transition many years in advance. And when the transition comes, we've established a relationship, and they rely on us because we've established some trust, and we understand their business, and help them sell that business when it's appropriate.
So when you're going in from an evaluation standpoint, a lot of the people that you're working with directly are clients of the company already.
Correct.
And you're just filling that role of helping in your area of expertise.
Yeah, and we also do some that, you know, may or may not have been valuation clients or appraisal clients. But yeah, primarily that's the key source for us. And you know, what we have done is we've done a valuation or appraisal before. For example, business owner, kind of like Gareth is saying, it's a small company. They want to gift some of the shares of that company to kids, grandkids, right. Cherry's Foundation. So we've done that work. We've established the estate planning, if you will, for the owner and helped them get that ready. So when they're ready to do the transaction, selling the company or having another outside investor make some significant investment in their company, we've already gotten to know them, and we know the ins and outs. Have they done the CRS system, to Gareth's point? Have they really gotten to a stage where they're ready for the transition? And we can talk about that a little bit more as you'd like.
Yeah, that's great. In terms of valuations, and maybe, Gareth, you've seen some of this as well, but it sounds like that's your bailiwick. What's been going on with valuations? I've had some clients of mine that, you know, they've gone through and they say, you know, I'm ready to sell. I'm ready to get out. They go through maybe somebody like you, and they come back and they go, I'm ready to go back to work. And
yeah.
they're like, I can't, man, that's like 2 years of what I'm making now. That's not going to cut it.
Yeah, right? And it's, you know, it is, you know, the economic downturn, and we're still coming out of it. Depending on the industry, it may still be in it. Just all depends on the industry that the particular business in. I'll tell you, we have seen some businesses that are just going gangbusters, and they have a niche business that's just doing really, really well, even in this tough downturn. Then you get into some businesses where, unfortunately, the economic downturn has had a huge impact. And the folks that are potentially buying that business know that. And the multiple that they saw in 2007, and you know, just to throw out some numbers, and you know, they may have ranged at that point. Again, this is all industry dependent and specific company dependent, but it may be, you know, 7 to 10 times that they saw some interest in. Whether or not they got that number, maybe another story.
Right.
But no, that would have been a great day.
Yeah,
I would
exactly.
Say,
yeah. Right?
Well, they always
think of that high watermark, right?
Well, the high watermark, yeah. and even within that, and I saw Gareth's reaction, and it's true. I mean, I think people start out at the very high end, and depending on the situation, it may come down to more realistic 5 to 7 times cash flow. But that number can be, you know, 2.5 to 3, sometimes as high as 4 or 5 now. And business owners, you know, remember that high water mark, and it may have been where they initially started some discussions, not where they finished up. And, you know,
there's a couple of other things on that. Perry will tell you, if you ask him where he does his valuation work, I'm sure that an awful lot of his valuation work will be around trust and estates.
Mm-hmm.
Probably do litigation support as well.
Yes,
and there
we
are
do.
Different places where valuation work is critical, and it's used by courts and the IRS absent real transactions.
Yeah.
But in the kind of market that I play in, which is business owner, and I think it's the direction of your question, a business owner who's looking to sell their business, what really matters isn't a valuation, because you can yeah. In a trust and estates environment, you're going to want a lower value.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And you can play with the assumptions. And I used to do this in the corporate world, you know, encourage some of the financial people to tweak assumptions to get values where I wanted them.
Right.
What really matters is what the business is worth on the street.
Yep. That's what the market will bear.
Yeah. So it's really, if you've got somebody who's interested in selling their business, the first thing is not to invest, you know, a few $1,000 to get a business appraisal or valuation. It's to talk to somebody who plays in the transaction space in their market and tell them whether they've got something they can sell and what the market looks like right now.
Have you guys found, and this may, Gareth, go to you more, on the buy side, that there's a bit of buyer bias? Buyers go in there and they're looking for a deal. It's like looking at buying a house and you're figuring, man, I should be getting a steal right now. And there's just maybe they're coming in with a lower price expectation than what reality really should be?
There are different categories of buyer. There are different types of people in the market. So there are private equity groups, consolidators of business, people who are out there looking for a steal, certainly. There are people who are very good at fixing businesses up, you know, mm-hmm. buying distressed assets.
Right.
And they're always looking for a steal. But certainly the people we represent and the people, when we talk to people, we encourage them to look for a solidly run but unimaginatively run business. So it's you're buying cash flows. You want to buy predictable cash flows.
Right.
And you're looking for opportunities to expand those cash flows in places you can identify. So the steal isn't really the approach.
Hmm.
I'm not really bumping into that as an issue on either side right now.
Hmm. When you say cash flows, just for our audience and for clarity, let's define that. That's cash flows that the business creates after expenses, right?
Correct. And you know, and Gareth had a good point. It is revenues and cash flow driven. And when we talk about cash flows, the typical, most people are familiar with net income, but really that has some things in there that are non-cash and that type of thing. So typically you're looking at what we refer to in the industry as EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And the theory there, and I don't want to go too theoretical, but the theory is that takes out the capital structure argument. So it doesn't matter if you're using debt to fund it or equity, EBITDA is the cash flow no matter how you funded it. you know, and just to follow on what Garrett was saying earlier, you know, there are different types of buyers out there. And one of the things that we're finding is the strategic buyer. And, you know, Gareth had mentioned the financial buyer, if you will, and they're looking for a deal. But then there's the strategic buyer, and it may be the big player in your industry who sees that you've carved out just a really cool,
yep,
very profitable niche.
Yep.
And they say, you know, rather than competing with these guys, why don't we just go ahead and buy them?
Yep.
So what they can do in terms of what Garrett was saying, it really is true. They can pay more, because they're not only looking at revenues and cash flows, but they're saying they're going to give something to synergies, and second, they're going to give some value to eliminating a tough competitor. And that's where you are seeing some really cool transactions going on and some higher multiples coming out of the transaction market, is where you do have that strategic buyer who,
yeah,
just wants to pay a little bit more than, say, a financial buyer might be able to pay.
They don't want to do the grunt work to get things going. They just want to take it and then be able to extract that and grow it, because they have already got this behemoth that it just, that piece just fits in, eh?
Right. And think of like a Coca-Cola or someone like that who's buying, you know, was it Dasani? You know, they're buying a brand that's already established. Now they can add that to their existing distribution network.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just one example, but there are many, many others you can come up with.
This gets to your original question. Is it an issue for sellers with buyers looking for a deal? A lot of this is actually controllable by the seller. And one of the things that is really important is to really prepare for and plan for a transaction if you're thinking of selling your business 2 or 3 years ahead of time.
Right.
Because to Perry's point, the buyer that you, if you want to maximize the value of your business, you'll run it in a particular way, you'll have a management team in place and some of the things we can talk about, but you will direct it towards the strategic buyer because they're going to pay most. So you cut all the junk off the edges that's peripheral to the business and not really interesting,
yeah,
to the strategic buyer, or even overlapping directly with the strategic buyer's business, and you'll look for a way to fit it into their business and line up 4 or 5 strategic buyers in kind of an auction environment.
How do you, most small businesses are, you know, the owner and some employees, and maybe it's 20, maybe it's 3, maybe it's 100, but mm-hmm, it's usually a smaller amount. And then that employer is drawing the majority of the income from that account or from that business,
mm-hmm,
either through distributions of dividends or whatever it may be called, depending on the structure of their company, but then also their own salary, right? So that salary is going to be going into that price that reduces the cash flow. How do you figure that out to be a fair number?
Well, that's a great question, John, because it is an important one, and it goes to the fact that some owners, you know, again, depending on the capital structure of the company, may decide to take a fairly low salary, and it may not be considered market. And when we do valuation work, or, you know, both on the sell side or just an appraisal, we have to look at what is the market for those key employees. And if for example, the owner, say if they're the 100% owner, they may pay themselves a very low salary and take it in distributions. So you may have to look at the cash flows and adjust them, mm-hmm, for what a market would require for a CEO of the company. Brings up another big point, is the other key thing about value is, does the owner stay on when the company is sold? That is, to Gareth's point earlier, it's a seller decision, and it's something you start talking to owners about 2 or 3 in advance. If this transaction occurs, are you going to stay on? Are you willing to stay on for 2 or 3 years? If you decide that you want to completely get out of the business, have you brought up that bench strength, as we like to refer, mm-hmm, to it, the COO who could take over that role? Because, you know, say, for example, if a strategic does buy you, they want to know that there's someone there, or even, frankly, for that matter, a financial buyer. A lot of private equity folks have made the comment to me. They want to make sure that bench strength is there, that they don't have to go out and find the CEO and see if it fits with the culture and that type of thing. They want to know that the bench strength is there to run the company post-transaction. And then that's very key.
Mm-hmm.
And at what value, or what I should say, what salary and total compensation package is that, you know, bench strength going to take on as you move them into the top spot?
Right.
What you're doing, if you're a buyer, you're buying quality of cash flows.
Mm-hmm.
So all aspects of this question will ultimately come back to the quality of the cash flow. If you, from the buyer's standpoint, you will look at the EBITDA, the cash equivalent of the earnings number, and you'll add back all those things that aren't relevant. So the vacation in the south of France and the yacht and the extravagant salary and all the rest. You add all that stuff back to come down to what you really think the EBITDA is.
Gotcha.
And then if you are going to be the sole owner and you're going to run it, that's then the cash that's attributable to you. If you're a private equity group and you're going to hire a couple of management members to run this business for you, you'll reduce the cash flow by that. But as we talked about with multiples, you'll pay a higher multiple for it. So
that's right.
You're going to play with the cash flows to get it to what it looks like to you will be the sustainable cash flows of the business.
So let's talk and shift back to a question that, Gareth, you had brought up earlier, which is you need to start looking 2 to 3 years
right.
ahead of time
yes.
as to how to structure your
Absolutely.
Business for sale. So tell us a little bit more about maybe a couple of the three most important things people need to be doing.
You need to run your business. If you're going to sell it and maximize the value of it, you need to be thinking of your business as a vehicle for transferable value rather than your own personal lifestyle.
Right.
There is a real tendency for business owners to become emotionally caught up in the business, be unable to delegate a lot of the operations of the business. They have all the key customer relationships themselves.
Right.
And if the owner is in that position, the business is overly dependent on the owner, and a buyer is going to look at that and say, well, can I really take that over?
Yep.
They're going to discount the value or say, that's not a business for me.
Yep.
So you need to be putting in place a management team, which Perry mentioned. You need to have some people who are strong, who have some of those key relationships, and who know how to run the business, who will go with the business.
And both on the sales, you know, the sales side as well as the
Absolutely.
Vendor relationship
both
side.
Both yeah. sides. Mm-hmm. And you also, you need to be... you need to have strong financial and operational mm-hmm. records. You need to have strong documentation. You need to have all the contracts around the customers and so forth. And you need to have the right kind of infrastructure. You're going to improve the quality and the value of the business if you put in decent sales procedures. You'd be amazed at how many small business owners have no idea how to run a sales process and actually have sales folks.
Yeah.
And if they have sales folks, they have weekly sales calls or sales meetings
right.
and track pipeline and all that kind of stuff. So that's how you improve the integrity of the business. You give the buyer the feeling that the business can run on its own and it's worth more. And the last one I'll say is, again, think ahead of time who... Actually, I'm going to give you two more. Think ahead of time about who your potential buyers are, because you want to point the business in the direction that's going to be most valuable to them. All right, so that talks about the market you're going to be in, the
yep.
geography you're going to be in, the products you're going to be in.
Yep.
And that actually will also make it more valuable to you, because it's a way of looking at your operations from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that as an owner you should really be looking at ahead of time is the corporate and tax structuring of the business from a transaction standpoint. It is my job when I'm representing a seller to get them the most for their business. It's the job of somebody like you, John, to make sure they keep it.
Yeah.
And unless they're working with you and tax advisors and so forth well ahead of time,
yep.
you simply don't have the time to position them so they keep as much of that as they can.
Right.
So we make sure that they're looking at that too and put them in touch with folks such as yourself to help them.
There you go. Shout out back to me. I love it.
Absolutely.
No,
it's key because, you know, like you said, it's not, as the famous line goes, it's not what you get, it's what you keep. And,
right.
You know, if you're selling your company, you know, to Gareth's point, and it is a shout out, but that's good.
Yeah.
You know, you really need to make sure that it's done in a tax efficient manner, and it's structuring, it's making sure that all the compensation structures are set up and that, you know, everything's set to go.
Let's go get into the mind of both people. And I'm going to have you get into the mind, Perry, of a seller.
Okay.
And Gareth, I want to get into the mind of a buyer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Perry, in the mind of a seller, what are the things that they're thinking? They're not saying, but you see on a regular basis that on the buyer side, it'd be really good to know, man, sellers are always thinking about this and you don't realize it.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that come to mind, but just trying to get to the top ones. You know, here's the mentality of the seller is, you know, I want to maximize my value here. But there are some subtle things that are in the background there that they may initially think of, but then put on the back burner as they're thinking of that big dollar sign.
Right, right.
One is, how, you know, I've had these salespeople or these key employees for a number of years. I want to make sure that they stick around. And that happens a lot. It's the human factor.
Right.
And that, depending on the seller, may come into play right up front, it may not come into play as till they get down to the bottom line and they hear someone saying, well, we're going to probably have to cut some people and that type of thing. So those are key aspects, the human aspect of it. And again, these are in some cases, the folks that have brought you to where you are. So it sometimes gets emotional at that point for the seller. Second thing is, I think the sellers really want to understand what the buyer wants to ultimately achieve. And it's a difficult one because every buyer is a different buyer. But the financial buyer may have a totally different take on things than a strategic. And even within financial buyers, and I think Gareth would agree with this, and among strategic buyers, they have different goals and what they want to do. Do they want to extend geographically? Are you set up to extend them geographically?
Right.
Or is it, we just want to, you know, maximize revenue and cash flows and turn this, you know, leverage this thing up, change it and what have you. So all those things come into mind, sometimes right up front, but sometimes down the road. But as a sell-side advisor, it's important to kind of walk through those scenarios with the seller and make sure they understand all these different perspectives that and they will impact value depending on how you look at them and what type of buyers you're willing to go to Gareth's point, and you know, how broadly do you want this to go out? The third and last key one, I would say, is how wide of a process do you want? Because some of the sellers don't think about, hey, if I really get in deep with four or five potential buyers, I'm giving my potential competitors a lot of information I may not want them to have. So that often comes into play. Again, a good sell-side advisor talks through some of these things with the seller up front to make sure they understand that you're going to have to give up a lot of information if you want someone to buy this thing and,
right,
and pay you maximum. Right. But there's some information, you know, you may want to limit how many people get those.
Yeah.
Get that information.
And last question on that piece. Have you seen deals? I can't imagine the answer on this would be no, but have you seen scenarios where deals have blown up because that buyer just isn't thinking about, there's something the seller's just not putting across and the buyer's not getting it, and it blows up? And could you give an example?
If I said no, I think everyone in the room would laugh.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. There are all sorts of things that can go on. And give you an example. We saw, and this is going back a number of years, but I'll never forget, and this was a big deal, where last minute, I mean, everything was in line, everything was looking like we were getting, you know, we had LOI, we were getting close to definitive agreement. There were a couple key things. We had the CEO of the company going to New York for a meeting, and literally he flew up there the night before. I fly in that morning. I get a phone call literally as I'm walking off an airplane. The CEO had passed away. Whoa. You know, just so, you know.
Can't plan for that one.
You can't plan for that one. You can't do it. I mean, there are just all sorts of different things that can happen. But there are other things that you can plan for. For example, you get into a situation where someone has simply not covered some regulatory aspect of the business that they should have.
Right.
And those are some regulatory legal issues that come up that may or not have come up or initially. And that's, frankly, the sell side advisor's key role is to make sure that that's fully understood up front and that anything like that. But I've seen some transactions, and this was one on the buy side. Unfortunately, the sell side advisor didn't really get into that level of detail. And that can be a real issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. The two things, there are a number of things that kill deals, but being unprepared is really top of the list. And to Barry's point, one of the reasons a seller should have an advisor is to make sure that they have thought through all the stuff that they need to get done in a deal and they're ready for it. The second thing on the list of top two or three that blows up deals is a surprise. Every business has warts.
That's
and
right.
You've got, as a seller, you've got to know what your warts are, and you've got to manage the communication of those warts. If something comes up during the deal flow, during due diligence, as, oh, whoops, what's that? Number one, it's a value problem. But number two, from the buyer's standpoint, it's, well, what else haven't you told me?
Mm-hmm.
So that will blow up a deal. Number three I'd put on that list is bad documentation. If you get a set of financials early on in the game and then you start digging into the sales numbers and you get sales detail that doesn't tie out with the numbers you were given in the first place,
yep.
and then you get tax returns that don't tie out and nobody
can
explain
what's going
why.
On.
Another one to throw out there too, just, you know, and this is more relevant here in the last few years, but say the buy side is a financial buyer and they said, well, we're assuming we can get 2x, you know, leverage on the debt,
right?
And then the bank comes back and says, well, you know, we can't really do 2. Maybe we can do 1.25. And that totally changes the numbers from the buy side guy's perspective. And that may blow up a deal. And I've seen that happen a lot lately.
That does happen with financial buyers in particular, yeah.
So, Gareth, your buy side of the what are they thinking that they're not saying?
They're thinking, number one, can I actually take over this business and run it? Which goes to the depth of the management team. How heavily dependent is the business on the principal owner?
Mm-hmm.
And if the principal owner goes away, which I've got to assume he's going to do, if I'm going to give him a bunch of money, even if he's an employee afterwards, I've got to assume he'll leave at some point.
Yep.
So can I really take this business over and run it? Second thing is then, so how am I going to run it? What am I going to do? And do I have the skills? Do I have access to the resources to do this right? The third thing, nobody's going to buy a business unless they can create value. So a buyer is always going to be looking to do something that the seller wasn't doing. A strategic buyer is going to fire the G&A, and they're going to look for revenue synergies, leveraging both customer base with crossing products across both sets of customers. Financial buyer is going to do some of the same as they bring businesses together, and an individual buyer is going to be looking to go into new markets or new products. They're going to be looking for other ways to drive value. So the buyer is always looking for those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to pay for them. That's
right.
Their upside.
That's why they're in the deal.
That's right.
They're not just in
they're
it.
They're going to pay you for. They're going to pay the seller for what they've already done, for the cash flows the seller's delivering. But they're looking for those upsides. So a well-prepared seller will have really good stories about the opportunities. So this is how you take the warts in the business and you communicate them effectively. There's lots of ways to tell good stories and help a buyer see that potential value.
Any particular examples of blow-ups when the seller's not understanding what the buyer's thinking and it just blows up because there's not that communication or understanding?
Communication is the right word. It's bad communication. And the examples I can think of, going back over a couple of decades of doing this, are all around surprises, really. The things, the unexpected coming up, environmental issues, issues with key employees that you should have known about ahead of time.
Not having a key contract for a key employee.
That's right.
Mm.
Or knowing a key, you should have known that somebody actually wanted to disappear. And
Not
being aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's hard because a business owner wants to believe, they have their handle on everything. But quite frankly, if you're in a big enough business where you're likely to sell it, it's gone past the point where you can control everything, and that's I won't say a rude awakening, but sometimes it's an enlightening moment for the business owner, and they realize that it's not just that small business anymore. I've got a lot of different things going on, and therefore I may not know about X, Y, and Z. And to Gareth's point, that's why you want an advisor to get in there and really dig in and understand the motives of people and understand, is this contract in place? Do we have this person locked down in an employment agreement? Is this person really maximizing their sales capabilities? A lot of it, I think Gareth would agree, comes from the key salespeople, and that becomes
Absolutely.
Becomes a key thing. And how do they respond if there's a transaction that occurs? So how are they going to be treated in the transaction? Does that mean that their commission rate is going to go from X to some subset of X?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, most of the things that would kill a deal will be seen fairly early on. You'll have customer concentration. You'll have over-reliance on one or two employees who are at risk. So a buyer is looking to identify these kind of issues early in the game before they've made a significant investment of time or money. And most of them you can. The ones that are going to be problems and blow deals up and cause pain on both sides are the surprises, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, great information. So if we're looking at the seller side of the of the business, or looking for people that are really ready to take that plunge. In your experiences, and I'll have this as more of an open question, when is a seller truly ready to sell?
That's a very, very interesting question, and it's really a personal decision. I think it really comes down to what is their, you know, state of mind at the particular time. Do they really believe that they can walk away from the business? Because I've seen some people start the process and say, you know, I really can't walk away from it. Or, you know, if I'm being told that it's worth, you know, X times cash flow and it's 70% of that, will I walk away? All those different types of things. It's a very personal decision.
It is a very personal. Per and myself both just looked at each other and smiled when you asked the question. But it, for both Per and I, it's a very important one for us to assess early on.
That's right.
Because it is really easy to find somebody, say, they want to sell their business, and you spend a bunch of time working with them, putting a book together, helping them figure out
right,
how to market
right.
it, and then you go halfway down the road, and they say, you know,
I can't do this.
Really hard.
Yeah.
So it is, when we've got a sell-side engagement, it is really important to get to know the individual. This is one of the reasons to start helping them think about exit planning a long time in advance, because you really get to know them, you get a feel for what drives their behavior. And on the buy side, it's really easy in the same way to take a sniff at a business and start diving in and looking at it and realize after you and your buyer have invested time and energy in this particular opportunity that the seller wasn't really a seller.
Right.
So you got to, Perry, I think those are just kind of instincts we pick up along the way that
you have to
figure this out.
Yeah.
It's important.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, changing course a little bit, let's talk about the general market conditions right now. What areas are, in your opinion, if you were to say, you know what, I've got some money and I'm a buyer and I'm going to go invest into a business and it's a good, maybe it's looking good or got some good legs for the future. Is there a particular area, sector, or kind of business that you would be attracted to right now?
I'll tell you, to me, people talk about this being the new normal. The new normal is actually the normal. We've had some aberrations in there, but I mean, the new normal is the normal. When we're representing somebody and advising them on buying a business, it's the same. Look at the cash flow of the business. Look at do you have diversity within the business in terms of, you know, lots of people, a management team, so the value is coherent within the business? Do you have distributed customers, so you've not got over concentration on any particular customers or customer sets? Is it a solidly run but unimaginatively run business? And
right.
are there these opportunities for growth out there that we can put our finger on? And it's not newfangled businesses, if you like. I mean, it's just good, solid, traditional manufacturing, distribution, service kind of businesses.
I would agree with that. I think it's again, ultimately it comes down to revenues and cash flows. We were seeing a lot in light manufacturing. I would say if you were to look at certain sectors that are doing a little bit better, you know, it's certainly anything related to healthcare, IT, certain areas of IT in particular. But overall, it's what Gareth said. It really comes down to the strengths of the revenues and cash flows and the overall company. What's interesting, though, is you do see some of these niches. And while it may sound like a horrible sector, for example, someone who does contractor work with commercial real estate, may sound like a completely horrible sector. Oh, gosh, why would I invest in that?
Yeah.
But we saw a business that does a lot of work with colleges and mm-hmm. government agencies, for example, that is really doing well. So to your point, you really can't look at the industry. You need to look at the industry niche. And so many times people want to say industry and say it's healthcare and put this big box, say, you know, big box here, but you got to look at what niche within that big box are they participating in and how is that niche doing. Again, I can tell you about some niches and industries you would never would think people would be interested in, and they're doing really well, and vice versa. I've seen, you know, in this healthcare space, there's certain industries that are getting really squeezed. So it's revenues, cash flows, what are the trends, how have they withstood? A lot of buyers want to understand, how do they withstand this downturn? Did they go up? Did they go down? Were they able to bring operating expenses down to meet where the revenues came down if they came down? All those type of things matter.
There's also an issue here.
No,
I agree absolutely with what you said, Perry. I mean, niches are really, really an important way of looking at this. It's also important, both from the buy and the sell side, as you look at deals right now, to be thinking of normalizing the cash flows. And something Perry just said made me think of that.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I looked at a few businesses late last year with a buyer, which were providing infrastructure essentially to manufacturing businesses or to warehouse kind of businesses. And those capital investment providing businesses had seen tremendous growth last year. Well, what that says is great, because it means that their customer base is making the investments that they've been holding off on for 3 years.
Right.
But if you're looking at buying that business, you've got to recognize that this is a one-year blip and it's probably going to go back down. So making sure you look at what is sustainable and what's normalized is kind of important right now.
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm going to wrap up with two more questions. And the first one is for both you guys on, as a business owner, what should I be looking for if I'm going to hire somebody to help me with this process, either on the buy side or the sell side? What should I be looking for from that person, and what should I look to decide who I want to bring in?
The first thing is you want to look for somebody, on whether it's buy side or sell side, who is focused on getting you to the closing table. Many, many, many sell side representatives focus on generating listings. So they focus on just marketing your business. And if they find you a buyer, they say, that's great. Here's a lawyer. You'll sit in the room and call me when you're done. And I'll get my check.
Yeah.
The deal process is enormously complicated. There's lots of problems along the way. And a business owner not only needs help navigating that process, but they need to stay focused on their business while that process is going on, and not be distracted from their business and let the business deteriorate, because that's the worst thing that can happen. So the first thing is an advisor being focused on the closing table. And that requires the advisor to have real transaction experience, to have actually run deals, not to be somebody who's just a good front-end sales guy. The second thing I'd suggest is somebody with a strong focus on process, because selling a business here is something that will take a year. Mm-hmm. You need to be really prepared up front. Ideally, you've spent time with your exit planning. But then when you get into the process, you need to be really prepared. You need to have the story set up. You need to know what the glide path is going to be. You need to be surrounded by the right team, which again will include somebody like you, John. It'll include a deal lawyer, and you need to pick that team. And you need to be able to manage that team. You need to have somebody who'll say, hey, Susie, you were supposed to have that employment agreement to me on Monday. It's Thursday. What can I do to help? You need somebody to help
push
get
you
through
the
process.
Yeah.
So discipline and process to get that deal to the closing table is also important. Hmm.
Yeah, I agree with everything Gareth said. I would say, again, honesty, openness, someone who's willing to listen as much as they're willing to talk. These are the basics, but Gareth covered a lot of the major ones, and I agree with all those. And really, at the end of the day, running the deal, understanding all the perspectives of all the people involved, the financial advisor, understanding the attorney, understanding how the CPA thinks, understanding the business owner, and understanding all the different perspectives. And to Gareth's point, getting them focused on getting you to the closing table with minimal distractions so that you can actually run a business, because we've all seen, and maybe this is one of the answers to your earlier questions, is people taking their eye off the ball during the middle of a transaction, and that ends up harpooning the transaction. Yep.
When somebody's looking for an advisor to help them sell a business, it's very easy to think it's just a broker. It's just somebody who'll kind of sit in the middle. But if you're doing it right as a seller, you're getting a seasoned professional who will be a business advisor, who'll be a trusted business advisor. Mm-hmm. So you should actually, as a seller, be looking to build that relationship over time and not just doing it out of the telephone book and a bunch of interviews.
Now that
you're looking for somebody you can rely on and you can trust.
That makes great sense, but I've got to go into a more detailed question on that. How do you know? What kind of questions can you ask as a seller or a buyer to feel like I'm getting somebody who's going to give me that versus, they're going to wax philosophically about what they're going to do.
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is you look at their resume, you look at what their history is and what they've done. And if they're if it's somebody who's a commercial realtor and has sold a bunch of buildings and a couple of them had warehouses in them, that's not somebody who's likely to have rich business experience. If it's somebody who's got experience as a principal selling businesses, they've got much more relevant experience. So the first thing is look at their resume. And the second thing is just spend time with them. Talk to them about your business. Do they get your business? Do they understand your business? Do they understand your business issues?
Mm-hmm.
Do they understand the kinds of things that you encounter when dealing with your customers? Do they understand the competitive environment? I mean, is it somebody who you can relate to in a real business sense? Because to sell a business, you've got to have business smarts.
I agree with everything Gareth said. What I would also say is it's, you know, you need to understand the resume. Have they done transactions? And in a lot of cases, it's important for the seller to understand that they understand the industry as well. Sometimes that's less important. It just all depends on the particular industry. The other thing too is does your advisor, your sell side advisor, understand who are the likely buyers and do they have relationships with them? Do they know who are the key private equity people? Do they understand who are the key strategics? And, you know, that's, you know, to Gareth's point, it's not something that happens in a five-minute conversation. It's something you get to know people over time. It's not that initial pitch and you never see them again. Do they keep discussing things with you? Do they want to have that follow-on conversation? Does that follow-on conversation get in more in-depth and show an understanding of where your business is going and what you're trying to accomplish?
The right advisor is somebody who's going to invest their time in building a relationship with you as a business owner, not somebody who's going to come in and pitch that you should pick them to represent selling your business.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. All right, so I'm going to wrap up. Perry, you first. We always ask at the end of our shows to get a pearl of wisdom. So what would your pearl of wisdom be to our listeners?
My pearl of wisdom is something for sellers to consider that they may have not considered in the past, which is an ESOP, Employee Stock Ownership Plan. And what I would say about that is, you know, people want to, in some cases, just want a buyer of the business no matter what. But think about an ESOP as a possibility. It may not fit for all particular situations, And let me say that up front. But if you've got some decent cash flows and you've got a decent business where an ESOP can really make a difference is if you have some key people that you want to make sure that their interests are aligned with whoever ends up, you know, owning the business, who better than the employees themselves? And that couldn't be involved as little as 30% of the business being sold to employees, as much as 100% of the business being sold to employees. Now, it does involve some additional work. You have to, in many cases, get a trustee involved, and the trustee has to make sure the transaction is fair, where the seller is paying, you know, is getting a fair price, but also the employees are buying it at a fair price. And there's some interesting things. But that's something to consider. And in the right situations, we've seen a big uptick in ESOP transactions. What's also interesting is that unlike a pure M&A transaction, the banks, in a lot of cases, are starting to be more receptive to ESOP transactions and allowing leverage to occur in ESOP transactions, which can, in many cases, help the owner of the business sell it at a higher value.
Great. Great. Gareth?
I'm going to give you one in a rather more non-traditional kind of sense.
Okay.
Most of the successful business people I have ever met, who I've gotten to know well, have some creative side of them. They cultivate the right side of their brain. And I think for everybody, it's really important, whether you write books, whether you play music, it's really important to do that. We in the business world, and particularly when you start getting caught up in these kind of conversations, mm-hmm. tend to live in the left side of our heads.
Sure.
And that is both closed, and it also saps the creativity and the imagination out of what we bring to the business. There's a reason why successful business people have that right side engaged.
Yeah,
it's because it helps them be creative and more imaginative in what they do. So I'd encourage everybody to do that.
Very great, great pearls of wisdom. So Gareth, if somebody wants to reach out and get in contact with you for questions or about helping to buy or sell a business, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
Give me a call, 404-790-5536. Send me an email, gyoung@abraxas.biz. That's abraxas.biz. Or I guess, John, they could reach out to you and you put them in touch with me.
Okay, great. And Perry, how about contact information?
Yes, feel free to give me a call. 770-309-6129 is my cell phone. And also email perry@hhadvisorsllc.com. Be happy to talk to anyone through, you know, John, if they get in touch with you or however
you guys both on LinkedIn?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely, and I'm a big LinkedIn user. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn as well.
Okay. Likewise. I'm believe in it a lot.
All right. Well, we appreciate the time you guys took today. Great conversation. Really learned a lot, and I think our listeners did too.
John, thank you for having us on. I've really enjoyed
it. Certainly appreciate the time. So to our listeners, we appreciate your time and hope that all goes well this week. Until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. We'll be right back.